the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage.
Welcome to our first semi-real episode of Sake on Air. My name is Justin Potts, one of your regular hosts and sake navigators, where bi-weekly I'll be joined by one or two additional members of the Sake 2020 team based here in Japan, as well as occasional guests once we're fully up and running. It's that fully up and running part that I actually wanted to take a moment to preface our early episodes with. For Sake on Air, you're getting a group of individuals that have chosen to dedicate their lives to the world of sake both personally and professionally in a wide range of capacities. What you don't get, at least not at first, are radio people. With these first couple episodes, we're keeping things simple as we give everyone turns behind the mic, as we try to figure out how we as a team can best go about creating engaging discussions in what is a somewhat foreign format to some of us. In these early episodes, the topics and content might be a little bit on the lighter side, but that's just so that we can prepare ourselves to tackle the truly important topics in a way that will do them justice and hopefully generate a meaningful dialogue with our listeners and expand the scope and angles through which the world enjoys and examines sake. Which is why we ask for just a little bit of your patience, as well as your support as we get things up and running. It's at this early stage when we need you most, so any feedback, any ideas, questions, topic suggestions, they're all more than welcome. We want to shape the future of Sake on Air together with our listeners, and all of your patient support and contributions at these early stages really mean a lot. So, with that somewhat long-winded opening, welcome to Sake on Air. All right, we have the whole team with us today. Does everybody want to go around and introduce yourself?
My name is John Gortner.
My name is Sébastien Lemoine.
Hello, I'm Shuso Imada.
My name is Christopher Pellegrini.
Hello, my name is Christopher Hughes.
And so here we are. We've finally made it. It's been a it's been a rather long road, but it looks like we have been able to make Sake on Air happen. And so I am really excited to take this opportunity to introduce everyone, so that you know who it is that's going to be sharing this information. So starting off, our top batter today, we have John Gontner. John, just to get in, I say you educate people all over the world. You travel all over the place and have been communicating sake to people for years and years. I imagine there are a number of people who have probably heard your story as far as getting involved in sake, but I would love to take this opportunity as well to kind of dig in and kind of get back to what was it? Were there any significant events or any significant encounters or people that really set you down this path initially?
There were many, but there was one in particular. It took place on New Year's Day, 1989. I came to Japan in August of 1988 to participate on an English teaching program with the government called the JET program. And I wasn't particularly interested in sake. Basically, not interested at all. It was something they drank hot, and that was all I needed to know. I couldn't see why all the fuss was being made about it. Yeah. And then an older teacher, maybe 10 or 15 years older than me, he invited me to his home on New Year's Day. And after we finished dinner, he came out holding five big 1.8 liter bottles, set them down on the table, and said, "Here, pick yourself a little glass here." I'm like, "All right." He says, "Let's drink some sake." I'm like, "All right, whatever." So he sat down, and he started to pour from the five or six bottles one at a time and explain to me and to teach me what we were drinking. And it was the first time that I ever was able to compare premium sake. In fact, it was the first time I ever had premium sake. It was the first time that I didn't have it hot. And as he started to talk and as I started to taste, I was blown away at the subtlety and the depth and how each one was a little bit different from the other. And I kept asking more and more questions and tasting more and going back and forth. And every time I would taste one, it would evolve from what it was 30 seconds ago. And I was just completely blown away about it. And I got more and more into it. And still, I never thought that I would actually make it my career, part of my work. But one day, after being in Japan for, I don't know, I guess it was about 6 years at that time, I went to a party where there was someone there who worked at the Japan Times. And I had known of this person, but I'd never met him before. And a bottle of sake came around. And it was quite inexpensive, not such good sake. And he said, "You want some?" I'm like, "Nah, I'm good." He's like, "What, you don't like sake?" I'm like, "Actually, I love it," which is why I'm not going to be drinking that. And he said, "It all tastes the same, doesn't it?" I'm like, "No." Yeah. And we took off on a conversation that led him to invite me to write an article for the Japan Times, which then led the Japan Times to ask me to write a column for them, which led to a publisher contacting me and asking me to write a book for them. And one thing just led to another. And when you start writing publicly about things, you can't make it up and you can't repeat yourself. So I had to study quite a bit. I got more and more involved in the industry just to learn so that I could write my columns and my books better. And one thing continued to lead to another. So that one fateful day pretty much led me down a path that's lasted about 30 years. And I'm just as enthusiastic about sake as I was on that day. You yourself, how did you get involved with this? I mean, you actually worked for a sake brewer for a while.
I did.
What led to that, or was that what led to everything else?
Yeah, no, so that was actually much later. I did not come through sake initially. Through me, it was more through through food, through fermentation, and actually more through being in touch with more rural areas of Japan. But I had used my body for a number of years as sort of a experimental unit, I guess you could say, as far as how it responds to different food, different diets, different things like that. I had always kind of struggled, even just from a young age, just kind of health problems and stomach issues and a lot of things like that. And so diet was sort of always something that it wasn't something I thought about until much later, but once I started experimenting, it became very interesting. And then I had the opportunity to come to Japan, and I found that being in Japan, I just generally felt significantly better. And I started trying soy sauce, miso, all these different things, and I started feeling great. This got really interesting. I said, wow, what else falls under this world of fermentation? And I started going out and visiting sake producers as well. And so for me, it wasn't initially so much a flavor experience. It was more, I felt really good and it all just kind of became really cohesive.
Did you find yourself naturally attracted to fermented products?
Yes.
And sake was just kind of under that umbrella.
And that came kind of along that path. At first it was kind of soy sauce. It was miso, things like that. And that just that sort of concept around fermentation was just became... It was a word that, of course, I understood was associated with all those things, but I hadn't really put it together. Started investigating further. A little something called koji became very interesting, and I started going, wow, why is nobody talking about this koji thing? As there was, you know, a lot of conversation overseas, like about food and health and all these different things. And there's this one element, aside from fermentation, this koji that's tying all of these things together. I was like, why is nobody having this conversation? And then exploring that, I found sake and went, wow, this is kind of the ultimate tool for communicating not just what makes koji and the craft and making all those things really, really great, but also taking that and then tying it together to all those other things, whether it's different types of food and different types of experiences. And the more I was able to then start taking sake and tying them into different experiences, I realized that there was an infinite number of things that I could be doing with sake involved. It wasn't just sake. I still kind of consider myself, I don't consider myself a person in the sake industry, actually. I try to keep a foot outside.
Actually, you better get used to it because you are.
Yeah, I know. I try to keep one foot in the other, you know, in the other, in some other field in some way, shape, or form. And so, yeah, for me, it was something that just kind of happened really organically, I guess. And the more I kind of explored and the more I got involved, the more interesting it became. And yeah. That's kind of where I ended up now. And so I ended up just sort of learning more. And the more instead of educational courses, it was more visiting producers. And then I started visiting producers and I realized, gosh, I haven't really done a lot of education. Maybe I should start doing some of this education thing. So I started doing some of the programs that they had available here in Japan. And I started just having more opportunities to do events or to talk about it or to share about it or people asking me to, hey, would you be interested in doing this or saying that? Or
and one thing led to another, right?
And one thing led
it's
to another.
Much
exactly,
how it works, isn't it?
Exactly. And, I said, and then after doing that, I ended up spending a year in Italy doing sake-related events and promotion and education and things like that. And after doing probably 3 or 4 events a week, every week for like 7 or 8 months, and just talking about it all the time, I realized there was a level to which I wasn't understanding the things I was talking about. And I kind of realized maybe the only way to develop a further understanding was to kind of get my hands dirty. And so then once I came back, I kind of shifted out of the big city and out to the countryside. And yeah, I spent a few winters hunkered down in the brewery. And so
how many years did you work there?
So 2 full seasons. And then a 3rd season kind of off and on. And I still
and you
help
lived
out
to tell of it.
I lived to tell of it. Yeah, it was. I said the first season, I questioned my survival. But it was an incredible experience. And I said not just the brewing side, but for me, what was more interesting is the challenges that sort of lie ahead for a lot of the small producers, because they're having to think about a lot of things, mm-hmm. Not just making a good bottle of sake. A lot of their worries and concerns and what's going to see them through to another 3, 4, 5 generations is how are they going to look at these other markets and international markets and these things. And so what are the strains that are on them? These people that are in charge of, you know, upholding, you know, these practices and a company and a family that's maybe been doing this for 5, 10, 15, 20 generations, while also now being charged with communication, marketing, travel, tourism, you know, all these other things. And so kind of get an insight to that was kind of, that was actually my main focus, was wanting to kind of get a little perspective on that.
So Sebastian, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what it is that brought you into the world of sake?
The people of sake actually brought me into sake. For many, many years, I stayed away from sake. And a wine lover, I was very much in that confused state of mind, because sake as a word, as you well know, John, means alcoholic beverage. And so it's a big bag that comprises all sorts of drinks, including the good Nihonshu we're talking about today. But a lot of other stuff as well. And it's only about 12 years after my first encounter with Japan that I finally got an opportunity to meet one of the great people of sake, one of the great sake brewers. And I was really, really impressed by the person, both his humility and his pride, the pride of the heritage that he's been carrying around on his shoulders for, one generation as far as he's concerned, but clearly with a lot of history behind him. And that's what's brought me into sake.
Can I ask Sebastian, when you're introducing sake, what type of sake do you find is the best one to start off with, if you've never tasted sake before?
There are a number of brewers, young brewers in particular, who offer sake with acidity level that are fairly comparable to a wine experience. And I must confess that I'm often using the sake as an introduction to the world of sake. Because even in my speaking to intelligent people, I do not underestimate their reflexes, or what their brains expect, I should say, when they see a semi-transparent liquid in a wine glass. And I think their cultural background is likely to influence their judgment pretty quickly. And I would say negatively if they get something which is too far away from wine.
Doesn't that sometimes limit the possible appreciation that people can feel for sake? That's an honest question, just an open one. In other words, don't they end up comparing it to wine then, as opposed to looking at it as something different? You don't have to answer that question.
Yeah, we should maybe leave that for another podcast. I think we have a topic for a podcast there.
All right, and so we have rotated chairs a little bit here. John and Sebastian have tapped out, and we have brought in Christopher Hughes and Imada-san. I always just say Imada-san because I'm here in Japan.
Hello.
I'm tentative to say anything other than Imada-san, but I feel like we should... Would you like to introduce yourself? How should everybody know you here in the?
Okay, my name is Shuso Imada.
So, before we dig into your background here, first, mm-hmm. tell us about where we are. This is a pretty lovely setup that we have here.
Yeah, well, this place is called Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center, which is a First, I have to talk about JSS, Japan Church and Sake and Church Makers Association, which is a central organization of about 1,700 sake and church breweries all over Japan. And this place, JSS Information Center, is supposed to be the PR basement of the industry of sake and shochu. So made in the purpose of becoming a gateway for those who are interested in sake and shochu. So it's been open for these 2 years.
Okay.
So it's still new.
Right. And it's great because this place is open weekdays every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can waltz in anytime. Mm-hmm. And there's probably close to maybe 100 different Nihonshu
available. About
100. All the time.
Well, our catchphrase here is we call it you can see, touch, and experience the world of sake.
For people who are interested, so this is if you want, they want to check on YouTube. We'll be putting this up on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
So probably the ideal listening experience is probably via podcast. But if you want to take a look at the YouTube channel as well, you can see this is where we're broadcasting
right,
from as well,
right.
too. So you can kind of see the nature of the space here. And it really is. It's decked out just really nicely with a lot of lots and lots of materials for education that you can get your hands on, and educated people behind the counter, and
that's
you can
right.
taste a lot of stuff for a pretty reasonable price as well.
Yeah,
too.
Very reasonable, I think.
So
I think
almost too reasonable.
That's right.
Where did you and sake meet?
Okay, long story. It's actually yes, my grandfather's was a son of a brewery in Hiroshima, and because he was the third son of the brewery, his elder brother succeeded the brewery, and he came to Tokyo to sell the product, and that was in Taisho era, which was about 100 years ago. And he started a small liquor shop to sell the products. And in the place called Shinkawa, in the middle of Tokyo, in Chuoku area. And Shinkawa, maybe many people are not so familiar with the name Shinkawa, but Shinkawa is the center of the distribution of sake in Tokyo since Edo period. So like 200 or 300 years. So long history of sake. So he, you know, moved from the countryside Hiroshima to the center of the distribution of sake, you know, and he started his business there.
If you want to sell your sake, that's the place to go, I guess.
That's right. And then my grandfather grew up the business to start a wholesaler of sake later on. And my father succeeded, and I was born as a son, the first son of him, instantly. Not my intention, but that happened to me.
It works out that way. And so so you have both a brewer as well as
that's right,
a wholesaler
distributor.
And distributor.
Yeah, so. That's a very good experience. So because I have the different aspect to the industry, that's a very, you know, very good experience for me, coincidentally.
Absolutely. And now you're here, you're in charge of, you're running, operating the information center here. But you've just been doing that for the last couple of years, as this is a relatively recent
that's right
thing. And prior to that, you had your own company, your own operation.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you were working
after
sake.
After doing my family business as wholesaler for about 25 years, I got independent and started my own business as a marketing consultation for the sake breweries for about 5 years.
Well, nice. And so then you were working with a number of different producers all over Japan
on
different types of product development and marketing and things like that.
That's quite interesting, too. That's a very good experience for me, too, because I had an experience then to sell sake at the department stores, you know, selling sake to the customers directly. Because wholesaling business is, you know, the intermediate business. It's between producers and the retailers. So you can, doing the wholesaler, you can't really see the customers directly. But, you know, if you become a maker side, you are more close to the customers. So it's a very interesting experience for me. Yeah.
And that's kind of a shift that you're seeing in, I think, a lot of food industry right now, and especially in the world of sake, is how do you bring that producer a little bit closer to the person who's actually enjoying what it is
that's
you're making.
Right, that's right. And that's very important for, you know, producers to know about that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And really, the people who are in the middle or part of that chain are people who are really adding value to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in your case, being involved in sort of the marketing and sort of product development side,
that's
you're starting to see really just in the last few years, the number of small startups and entrepreneurs and people really trying to get into that sort of product development marketing side, really trying to carve out a different niche.
Finding things are really changing for these, you know, several years, especially.
A lot.
And it's really, is becoming really fast now.
Really, really fast. It's hard to keep track of who's making what, where, when, where it's all going. It's exciting in that there's a lot more product out there, some interesting product, some types of product that did not exist just a few years ago. At the same time, it's, you know, it's tough to know where different things are coming from. The communication is getting a lot more challenging.
That's right.
It's there's a lot of good coming from it, and there's a lot of challenges coming from it as well too. And it's happening so quickly.
That's right.
The market still requires great deal of development as well.
I hope so.
So I said it's going to be. It's a really. It's one of the most pertinent. Maybe one of the most significant challenges and areas for opportunity right now, whereas marketing, that's something that really hasn't been a brewer specialty for a long time. It's entrusted to a lot of places, like you're saying, you're talking about these wholesalers and distributors who are not necessarily marketers, but
that's right. And for a long time, sake, you know, before, like several decades before, sake didn't have, you know, as many brands as now. And they usually, one brewery has one brand, and they sell just that, you know, 99 Masamune or 99 Sakari or like that. So it's easy for the retailers and wholesalers to sell it, but nowadays things are totally different. So the diversity of sake has been really broadened.
Absolutely. The thing is, now the challenge is we have to scale the market.
That's right.
With the number of products that we have out there, which is, I said, that people have a lot more choice and people are a lot more.
Yeah, it's really good for the international market, because, you know, in foreign countries, people eat different things than Japanese things, and the previous sake type is good for a Japanese food, but maybe not good for the Western food or Indian foods, Chinese food. But sake nowadays are, you know, so much varieties. They're very rich type, very thick type, very raw type, very sparkling type, everything. So you can choose the type of sake to you know, pair different types of food. That's very interesting, and that's very important from now on.
Which is going to be which is going to be a lot of fun, because out of all the sake being produced, it's only a fraction that's actually only making it overseas right
now.
Right. You're looking at what, like 2% or something like that?
Well, 3%? Now it's 4%.
It's about 4% now?
but it's still,
it's a small fraction
actually
out there, which means that a majority of the population is only has an opportunity to encounter a very narrow range as to what's actually
that's
out
right.
there. And so, you know, as with a lot of other beverages, whether it's beer or wine, or a lot of those markets really grow organically within those markets over time with,
that's
as
right.
you said, what the lifestyles of people, how they gather around the dinner table, where they spend their money, the types of things that they eat, and different types of those products then tend to come about as a result of those things. And so now that we have all this variety in the world of sake, there's a whole lot more opportunity for different markets, both within Japan as
that's
well
right.
as outside of Japan, to start
that's
to
right.
latch on to these different styles.
How exciting.
Things. I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so.
That's right.
And so now you've got this lovely space here at the Information Center. What is your, I know you do events quite regularly, together with brewers, a lot of stuff really welcoming the international community as well.
That's right. I held monthly events called Sake Salon, where it's mainly for the non Japanese speaking people. It's a small party, and we invite a brewery to the salon to explain about sake, and you know, we listen to the story, you know, background of the brewery, and enjoy their sake. That's a simple style of events, but very, very interesting to know the different, you know, the theory philosophy that breweries have, and to enjoy sake with other sake fans, international sake fans.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good, very good.
And I'm trying to do more cultural event in the near future, like, you know, listening to mixing sake with the traditional Japanese culture, like rakugo and sake, and maybe the kota, you know, the song, the Japanese folk song with sake.
Or, yeah,
that's going to be very interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, so what we'll do is we'll put some of it for these events and things like that. We'll put links to that in the show notes,
yeah,
so that people
please.
Who are who are coming, they can take a peek at the sake salon information
and
see what's happening here. So if you for people who are coming to Japan, it's a very good entry point too.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I hope so.
The world's gonna, that's
the
goal.
I meant to.
Right. Very good. Excellent. Well, we'll cut it there for now, and we will have you on again regularly. For your input and wisdom, and we'll keep the party going.
Okay, let's do that.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. So, Chris, what is it that motivated you to dedicate your life to the world of sake?
When I graduated university, I started working for a distribution company. Not a company distributing sake per se, but for those of you that I haven't said yet, but I mean, I'm from the UK.
Yep.
And I actually, when I graduated university, I moved down to London and I started working in London. And yeah, I mean, just by chance, the first job that I landed was working for a company distributing Japanese food and drink products to restaurants in London. And you know, I had no idea that I was going to discover sake, but the first kind of year working for this company, they invited me to kind of take part in a study session with a brewer, one of the brewers that we were actually, you know, stocking their sake. And they came down from Japan, you know, to our office, and they did this study session. And wow, I was hooked instantly, because for me, and I often refer to it as the story of sake, in this kind of presentation, which was basically, you know, how sake came about, the history, you know, the origins, and I'd not tasted any sake yet, okay? Mm-hmm. I was just listening to this presentation. And everything which I loved, I'd fallen in love with about Japan, came out in this presentation. That's what hooked me. And like I say, I didn't have this wine background, so it's not like you had to tear me away from wine or anything. I'd actually had a lot of problems with wine, you know, reasons that I could never really get into it or enjoy it. And then when I did taste this first glass of premium sake, the first thing that I realized was it was just so easy to drink. It was like flavored water, you know, lovely flavored water with alcohol, obviously. And the brewer put it in a wine glass. And I was like, hey, you drink this in a wine glass? You know, it's not a wine, right? And just so easy to drink. And, you know, these flavors, you know, I'd never tasted before, just blew me away. So in a way, it was kind of I got into sake the opposite way around.
That's right.
You know, I got into sake first, and now I'm kind of studying a little bit about wine first to understand more about maybe how I can introduce sake to wine lovers. You know, if I understand a bit more about which types of sake have which kind of, you know, have a relation to which types of styles of wine, then maybe if someone says, oh, I like this particular style of wine, then maybe I'm thinking maybe I can offer them, you know, a particular style of sake or whatever. But yeah, so I can relate though with Imada-san, because, you know, I did work in the distribution side of the industry for a long time. And it's very interesting seeing how it's evolving and people are warming to it, you know, and getting interested in it.
Yeah. And that's it. So we haven't dug into that quite yet, but you have a pretty significant role in sake education here in Japan.
Yes, I'm very lucky and very honored to be teaching the WSET, the Wine, Spirits, and Education Trust's sake course here in Tokyo. And for those of you who don't know what the WSET, who the Wine, Spirits, and Education Trust is, well, it's basically a wine school in London. And, you know, they've been going for a long time. They have a very well-established wine course. And in 2014, they decided to set up a sake version of the course. And, I was invited to become an educator last year and went down to Kyoto and took the initiation ceremony. And so I've been teaching that here in Tokyo. And I've always really enjoyed sake education. Even when I was working for the distributor in London, I would often go to restaurants and do sake trainings for the staff there. And I quite enjoyed that. I quite enjoyed the sake education side of things. So I thought
maybe. So you had the experience of teaching sake before you came
yes.
to Japan?
Yeah.
How did you study about sake?
Well, this is an easy one, you know. I mean, this won't surprise you, I don't think. But of course, John Gortner's books, you know. and I was, I was so happy to be able to finally meet John in Tokyo in 2014 when I first came here to, continue my study. Embark on a little sake study pilgrimage here, and we finally bumped into each other at a sake event in Ikebukuro, and I was, oh my god, when these idols finally meet their these fans of famous musicians finally meet their idol, it was a bit like that. I didn't quite know how to introduce myself to John, but he's such a modest guy, so it's very easy to I'd say, hey, John, I love you, I learned sake from you, always wanted to meet you. And he said, I know who you are. I've already heard about you and stuff, because he actually is good friends. He works with a distributor in London who I know quite well. And we'd already been introduced, indirectly. Mm. I studied from, I had John's books to study from. And there's also a brewer in Kyoto. Philip Harper, and he writes great books about sake as well. And I think we're very lucky, actually, to have such great English literature about sake available.
That's right.
But I also studied from Japanese books. And actually, I think the thing that, in a way, I think I had a kind of a head start when I was working for the distributor. I was so lucky to be able to meet brewers themselves. And when they came over to the UK and we would go out and, visit restaurants together, there would be a lot of time sat on the train or whatever on the way to the restaurant. And I would have plenty of chance just to ask them all these questions. And you don't even have to ask them. They will just tell you about sake if you just sit there and listen.
And now we're going to shift gears just a moment to chat with Christopher Pellegrini, our shochu guru, who is going to be taking us on a shochu-infused journey for this and future episodes. So, Chris.
Justin.
We got you in here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we managed to make this work. We've got a lot of sake or, Nihonshu folks here.
Yeah.
Kind of heading up the show. You've got a lot of pressure on your shoulders here.
I gotta bring it.
You gotta bring it. Bring the best.
Well, I'll bring something.
Here. Bring something early. We're trying to just kind of get our listeners acquainted with who the heck is yapping on these mics.
Okay.
And so since we got you in here today, as we get these things rolling, I just kind of wanted to take a minute and kind of dig into how in the heck you ended up here. What brought you into shochu and what pulled you into this? The world of this mysterious beverage?
That's a good question. I'll try to keep it somewhat focused and somewhat short. I used to brew beer in the States. Okay. I did that for a number of years. I was actually the youngest commercial brewer in the United States for 2 years. I was too young to drink what I was making.
Okay.
And through that experience, I developed a really intense pride and interest, pride in my job and interest in small batch handmade products. Drinks. I mean, the type of drinks that people will line up to buy.
Yeah.
And I turned into the most insufferable underage beer snob you've ever met in your life. You could not talk to me about beer, but I was only I think I was 17 when I started brewing for Otter Creek.
Okay.
Anyways, I fast forward a bit. I got a master's degree in education, and I really love teaching. And I also happen to be a performer. I was on stage my entire childhood. I do a lot of TV drama and movie acting here in Japan. I come to Japan in 2002. By 2003, I kind of trip and fall straight into shochu. It was at a sake bar, of all places. And the bartender's like, here, try this.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the biggest rabbit hole of my life.
Yeah.
And what happened in the interim was, of course, I learn more and more about shochu and awamori, of course, shochu's cousin from the Okinawan Islands. And I just wanted to share it. And I started doing tastings and meetups and all these other things. And shochu became the fulcrum for these three really big passions of my life. One being small batch handmade quality drinks. The second being performing. The third being education. And so shochu is all of that, like in one little bundle for me. And that's kind of why it has me and probably will never let go of me. It's just what really gets me out of bed in the morning. I love the heck out of what I do right now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. It comes through. It shines through.
I get a little excited, so I'll try not to chew on the microphone.
That's all right. That's all right. Now, so when you say that, though, so what was it then about shochu? Because I guess all those things could be said for sake as well. A lot of people now, and nowadays in particular, tend to step into the sake rabbit hole. You know, there's not many opportunities to meet or engage with shochu as there are with sake yet. That's probably one of the factors.
Right.
But as I said, when you come to Japan, both are more than readily available. There's pretty much equal opportunity to stumble upon both.
Absolutely.
And when you start looking at small and craft and these things like that, those are all things that could be said about sake or nihonshu as well. Was there something different about shochu? Was there something engaging or fascinating or that really kind of got its claws in you?
Well, I'll never forget that first time I ran into it in that little dirty izakaya.
Those are the best places to encounter beverages.
Uh-huh. And I was drinking nihonshu the whole time. And then one day the bartender was like, here, try this. And it was barley shochu.
Okay.
And I was just like, oh, that's definitely a spirit. I couldn't speak any Japanese at that time, really. That's definitely a barley spirit, or it's a spirit. I didn't know what it was made from. And I was like, oh, it's got a little bit more flavor than I was expecting. Oh, not so bad. And the bartender was kind of surprised that I didn't dislike it. So then he gave me sweet potato shochu, which tends to be a love-hate type of thing. It's kind of like country music, I suppose. And it really, that one I smelled, and I actually accused him of making a mistake. I said, this is not shochu. You gave me shochu before. This is not shochu. And that was where my mind started to kind of explode because he said, no, no, they're the same thing. He couldn't explain why. They're the same drink. They're so completely different. And that for me was like, wow. And then he gave me some rice. And that again was totally different. And I think I also had some soba, some buckwheat shochu before the end of the evening. And I was like, somebody please explain to me how these four drinks are all called the same thing. Why are they all shochu? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that is true. And different from sake is your raw materials. You can start getting really creative there.
Exactly. And there's a official list of about 53 raw materials that you can use. Of course, the sweet potato group is huge because there's dozens of varietals that you can use. And I was just smitten. I was thinking, wait, why isn't this known anywhere else? Why didn't I know about this for the first 3 months that I was here in Tokyo?
All this bar visiting, how did I just encounter this now?
How did I not notice this? Yeah, because I went in asking for sake.
Yeah.
And I couldn't read any of the kanji, so they all looked like sake bottles to me, as I'm sure they do to a lot of people who visit this country. But that was the beginning of my fascination. There was so much diversity in the flavor and aroma. There were several different ways to drink it, although I was mostly drinking it on the rocks at that time. And the variety, the diversity, the flexibility just fascinated me. And that was the start.
It's interesting you mentioned barley shochu was the one that initially grabbed you. Because actually for me too, that was the first one that kind of resonated with me as well. Whereas I feel like, and maybe this is just me not being an everyday shochu drinker, but I feel like most people tend to lean toward imo, tend to lean toward potato. That tends to hold a bit more of the market and tends to be what people generally associate. Whereas for me, barley was the one that initially resonated with me. And that was the one that kind of stuck with me. And that I still tend to gravitate toward today as well, given the choice. Not always, but
I mean, sweet potato is certainly the market leader in terms of sales. Barley's number two domestically. And for me, sweet potato shochu is kind of like your IPA. It's your peated whiskey. It might not be for you right at the start, but once you kind of get used to it, you just want more and more sweet potato. You want it funkier and earthier and spicier, and then it just never ends. And then some people just won't drink anything else. Having said that, barley rice shochu tend to be very, very easy access points for a lot of people because they're just easy to comprehend. People love beer, they love whiskey, so okay, barley makes sense. And those also tend to be the most common, the biggest sellers in foreign markets as well. Sweet potato doesn't really hold a light to any of those other products at this point. It may, hopefully it will in the future, but yeah. I mean, and I guess to bring it back to what you were saying, there's a lot of very, very lovely, grainy, some with like cacao notes and coffee note, roasted barley drinks. Absolutely lovely any way you serve them.
No, that's what you were getting at, though, is there are steps involved, though, right? You know,
absolutely.
Is getting into that. And that's something that I think is going to be really important to when we start getting into sake and things like that.
Yeah.
Start talking about the different types and varieties and sort of the role that those play in people's lives and how that sort of changes for a lot of people over time.
Yeah.
A lot of people just maybe for one reason or another, based on their diet, where they're coming from, what they normally eat, where they spend their time, where they dine. They're just not ready yet for a certain profile.
Yeah, sure.
For a certain type. Not that one is better than the other in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. It's just different people are ready for different things at certain times. And you tend to see similar things in sake as well, too. You're talking about, you know, those really, that peaty shochu that once you start getting into those complexities, you stand... It's hard to go back from.
Yeah.
It's hard to go back to, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, right now in the sake world, of course, you've got a lot of people are interested in Kimoto and Yamahai and the old, really, like a lot of acidity to them, or more acidity than is normal, and just a lot more complexity.
Absolutely.
There is a process working up to those drinks.
Absolutely.
And it should be interesting to see which parts of the world zero in on sweet potato first. One thing that's interesting for me, when I do tastings in Tokyo every week with tourists that come in, and Scandinavian guests latch on to sweet potato shochu really quickly. I don't know why. I think it has to do with some of their culinary traditions. But I have had a number of guests go, wow, this reminds me of my childhood somehow, home cooking, something like that. And they just immediately are into it. Whereas North American guests tend to be kind of hot or cold. They either think, oh, this is really interesting, or they think, oh, no, we're not doing that today. Sorry, I can't drink that.
I actually really like the idea of a world where a very unique style of sake or shochu is just ridiculously prevalent in other places. Like if you wanted to have the best nigori sake in the world, you have to go to Russia or something
like
that.
That would be really cool.
Like that would be kind of amazing. You know, you have to go, you know, you have to go to Spain. If you want good rice shochu, that's the place to go, you know, or something like that.
That would be really interesting.
You know, it makes sense that it could happen that way. You know, got different, you know, just based on climate, based on people's lifestyles, how they spend time, that there are really specific styles that could become really, really prevalent in different places.
Oh, absolutely. And when I have a guest who's, for instance, really interested in mezcal, then of course I'm going to shove sweet potato shochu in front of him or her. But, you know, on the other hand, if you have somebody who's more interested in, you know, what would we say? Someone who does a lot more vodka or gin or something like that. Well, then you've got a number of other drinks you could work with. Of course, rice and barley. Somebody who likes rum, of course, you're going to push them towards Kokuto to start out. But yeah, there's a learning curve for every individual consumer. And as the nerds in the room feeding them these drinks, we definitely have to be very cognizant of that. And if we do it right, then we're going to have new fans, new evangelists all over the place.
So it's fun. Every single person teaches you something as well, too. It's
great. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's what makes this kind of fun.
Yeah.
Nice. So what's your current mission? What's keeping you excited nowadays, right? You just got back from New York, right?
I did. I was just on a research mission to New York City and San Francisco. And this is for a PhD that I'm doing, which is, I think the official name, it's quite long. It's Global and Regional Bioresource Economics. And if you kind of dumb that down a little bit, well, actually, that's code for I'm in over my head. But if you dumb that down a little bit to agricultural economics, that's a little closer. But what I'm actually doing is shochu and awamori export and marketing. By export, I mean channel selection and maintenance, looking at the supply chains and the choices that the makers have along those supply chains. They have none. That's the answer to that question.
You've already written your thesis. You've come up with the
zero control at the moment. But and just trying to help them to make decisions that are going to, that they will be able to leverage positively for sales in the future. So I was in San Francisco, in New York, interviewing people along the supply chain, and it was fascinating. I learned so much from talking to people. And fortunately, when you say that you're doing research for a PhD, all of the facade drops and people stop trying to impress you with how much they know about the drink, and they just tell you what you want to know. So I was asking very simple questions such as, you know, how do you present these drinks in your shop? You know, which drinks are nearby? And then also, you know, who's your typical customer? Tell me about them. What's the archetype? And the really fascinating answers, a lot of conflicting information. And
there's a lot of that out there.
Yeah, there really, really is.
It's surprising. It's not so surprising when you look at kind of the state of things, but it's noteworthy as to how much actual contradiction stuff there is out there.
It can be both kind of chuckle worthy and then other times just bang your head on the wall type stuff. But yeah, it's everywhere. And with shochu, probably more than sake, especially in the American market, because of Korean soju and because of the way some companies falsely label their products to say soju to get around, it's a licensing issue in California state. There's a lot of confusion. And I would posit that the shochu industry is not starting from zero knowledge or zero chishiki in the States. They're starting from negative territory because for two decades, they've been teaching people the wrong things about shochu. And it was just fascinating. And everybody is pissed off about that. Everybody who sells shochu is like, why do they do this? Right? Everybody said that. And consumers are just like, oh yeah, I've tried soju before. Yeah, okay, yeah, right. Okay, yes, I know you have. I'm sure you have. Have you tried shochu though? Yeah, same thing. Okay. Oh, we got a lot of work to do. But it was very educational. And I just got back last week and my liver is ticking like this. But yeah, it was a very good trip.
Very nice, very nice. I said we're going to have a whole lot to dig into there. There are only about 100,000 parallels that I was ready to jump in and dig into right there.
Yep.
But we'll cut it there for the time being.
Okay.
Leave everybody on a little bit of a cliffhanger.
Got you. Well, thank you very much, Justin. I appreciate it.
I said there's gonna be a little bit of shochu and dabbled into each and every episode. Hopefully,
yes,
is what we're shooting for.
Thank you for the opportunity and the space. I will give you the best I got.
This is gonna be fun.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers, brother.
Cheers. Thank you.
And with that, we've come to the end of this episode of Sake on Air. You can find Sake on Air at Sake on Air on both Instagram and Twitter. If you have questions, we would love to get your questions, show ideas, feedback, things like that. Again, we are just getting started here. We've got a lot to learn. We're trying to figure this out as we go. You can reach us at questions@sakeonair.com. This show is made possible with the support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association and recorded at the Sake and Shochu Information Center in Tokyo, Japan, located just a matter of minutes from Tokyo Station in Toranomon. The Information Center is open Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Sake on Air is hosted and organized in collaboration with the Sake 2020 Project, with production and additional editing support from Export Japan.